moment, because there's going to be some point where somebody, most likely me, is going to say something that, you know, the lawyer is going to want to have scrubbed off the internet. And then I'm going to have to say, sorry, it's actually gone live. Nothing I can do, boss. In which case, I'll be snookered. Right. Anyway, we're live, everybody. Welcome to Brain Food Live on Air. We are bringing it to you every Friday. It's episode 96. Thank you for being with us. As ever, we've got a loyal following. It's amazing how many people end up watching the show. I'm pretty certain these days that we're always getting like 50, 60 people regularly turning up week on week. And when we rarely fall under like 100 in terms of concurrent viewers, and oftentimes get into the thousands if you include all of the channels. So thank you very much for supporting Brain Food Live on Air. Great to have you all with us. Okay, so as ever, we do a sound check at the start of this. I just want to make sure everyone can hear me. So if you're on Crowdcast, if you can hear me okay, just say hello. In the chat stream there, should be on your right-hand side. We are multicasting on LinkedIn Live. So if you can hear me on LinkedIn, you know what? I don't think I'm out on LinkedIn. God damn it. I knew it would be some sort of screw up. It is annoying how this oftentimes works. Oh, actually, no, I'm live. I figured it out. Sorry. The reason why I know I'm live, I just heard myself speak on LinkedIn, freaking out as to why it's not live. Anyway, if you can hear me on LinkedIn, please say hello. Let me know you can hear me okay. That would be good to know. Thank you very much. And we're also broadcasting on Facebook Live. So if you're watching it in the group, please give me a thumbs up, thumbs down, something like that. Let me know you're alive. Okay, I think that's all good. People can hear me. It's going well. We've got a new sponsor for us this week. So round of applause to our new sponsor, ChartHop. ChartHop are a really interesting business out in the US, but obviously growing global, and I think super relevant for this type of period. They're a business that basically helps you visualize what your organization currently looks like. So if you need to know what your org chart looks like in real time, if you need to figure out where your headcount issues are, you want to figure out sort of where your distribution of staff is, the online sort of remote on-premise, all that type of stuff, ChartHop are a business to pay attention to. They're a business basically that allows you to build a dynamic view of your company through this real-time org chart generation, custom analytics, and headcount planning. You should absolutely be checking out a product like this, if not ChartHop itself. So I've just shared the link in the chat stream there. If you want to check them out, please do so. Okay, let's move on with the rest of the show. Welcome back to Adam Gordon. Who I think you've been missing the last couple of weeks, haven't you, Adam? You've been like too busy to get onto Brain Food, it seems. Other things to do, you know, more important stuff.
I'm pretty sure I wasn't invited, actually, more of the point.
Yeah, you were upgraded, man. What can I say, you know? I say one thing to you, I say another thing to the other guests, you know? That's the way you got to play it. But anyway, good to see you, and good to see you back in the hot seat, mate.
Yeah, thanks very much for being here. I will never miss it, ever.
Good stuff. Well, listen, Adam, we always kick off with a review of the Brain Food from last week. So did you read it? And if you did, what was interesting? And if you didn't, just make something up.
Right. I did. And it was a real cracker. So tons of great things. I think they're getting longer. Or I think they got longer about 3 or 4 months ago. And they've stayed at a longer length. Because I now, just in the last like 3-4 months, every time I open it on Gmail, I have to click to open display in a new page. Yeah.
There's two things on that. So actually, you've brought up a relevant point. They have got marginally longer simply because I'm writing a little bit more on them. But actually, there's a setting in Gmail in particular that starts to truncate the volume size of the email that's sent through. And review, the software I'm using basically sends quite a large file size because there's a lot of images and stuff like that in. So unfortunately, a lot of the links that are not sort of on the top half of the email can get sort of knocked in terms of their visibility, I'm afraid. Most of that sort of brain food stuff, like the jobs and who's hiring, stuff like that, which is a shame. But, you know, until review fix this, then it's difficult to sort out. And it may not be fixable. It's just an arbitrary limit that, you know, email providers have set. Anyway, what was floating your boat, man?
So I'm going to go down to the bottom for quickly because, and this probably won't take long, but I just wanted to say the variety of jobs at the end of the Brainfood newsletter is really quite astounding. There was one which was a senior talent architect. Mm-hmm. The variety of job titles our employers are now applying to, you know, different jobs in what used to be just recruitment is, you know, really clear. And I think that's a sign of our industry maturing or our profession maturing.
It is. We're wrestling with these different terms, aren't we? And it might actually be worth doing a Brainfood Live and actually, like, is the diversification of job roles substantive or is it cosmetic? Like, is it just the case sometimes, you know, a cynic would say, look, you're still a recruiter, you've decided grandiose your title or something, call yourself an architect, you know, that kind of thing. Or is it substantially different? You know, what does an architect do compared to a recruiter? And I think there's a case to be made either side. So basically, I think there's a very good point to be made. Someone like Mitch Sullivan, I'm sure he's watching this because Mitch is a fan. He just dismisses everyone as a recruiter. Still calls himself a recruiter after all these years. Now, I totally respect that. But at the same time, you know, I think, you know, we are exploring the different terminology. And do we need to do that? Is it something worth doing? So interesting to pursue. Brainfood Live for another time.
Yeah, okay. I'm all up for creativity when it comes to talent attraction. And I can see that Susanna likes it as well. But I think that using Spotify song names in the Spotify playlist effectively as a recruitment advert is a really creative idea, but it's not scalable and it's really gimmicky.
Yep, 100% on this.
So it's cool. It's a cool, fun thing to do, but yeah, it's not for everybody.
It was. I mean, I kind of looked at that the first time around and it wasn't a new thing. I think the first time I saw this was a couple of years ago, a guy called Joseph DeGar Wilkinson, a good lad who works in Berlin. He did something like that in Zalando. By the way, folks, if you don't know what this topic is, it's basically using the text on the job on the titles of the song and selecting songs basically to help you construct a sentence. So you might use "Hello," you know, the sort of Adele's famous songs, the start, and then figure out sort of the rest of the sentence and have appropriate words and song titles for that. But yeah, big gimmicky. It's one of those things I kind of made the comment that it's one of those where it probably won't work, but it's worth doing it for the PR and the marketing and so for people can say, hey, that's creative. And that in itself is going to be valuable, right?
I saw some of the candidate responses, which were really, really kind of two things. The second part of the candidate responses was, but cool playlist. The first part was, I don't have the skills you're looking for, or I'm not looking for a job, or something else that was just a little bit like, I'm not the droid for you.
Yeah.
You know, but it was good. They enjoyed it, but yeah, it's not an industrial scale talent attraction solution, I don't think.
No, and actually, Spotify is interesting in other ways because it could. There's ways in which you can inject adverts in Spotify, can't you? But I don't know, like formally buy them. But I don't know anybody who's done it from a recruiting point of view. But maybe you could, if you could map sort of someone's song preferences to a certain job type. Maybe, I mean, you're stretching it a little bit there, but maybe there's some correlation. You could give it a shot, you know.
Maybe. So like Megadeth means they're probably a software engineer, that kind of thing.
Well, yeah, you're going to have to totally like embrace stereotypes, aren't you? There's no way of not embracing a stereotype here, but it might actually correlate. Then you make the assumption, okay, this person might do X, and then hit him or her with an advert and see how it works. Good thing about sound only adverts, by the way, is that they're very, very immersive. Oftentimes, people are listening to music when they're not looking at screens, for instance. They could be walking. A lot of people do it on walks, for instance. That might be a Spotify playlist. I wonder if an ad pop in there, you know, you pay attention to it. So there could be underexplored options there.
Yep, agreed. Okay, so quite a few others. The one next one would be Jeff Bezos is, I think history is going to show he is of as much, if not more, significance to our world than Steve Jobs. Yep. He stepped down as CEO. Amazon's the Death Star of business. I'm absolutely convinced that they are going to run every industry in the near future. But anyway, he stepped down as CEO, which doesn't really mean very much. Doesn't mean he doesn't control the company. But I enjoyed reading, going back, that throwback to, I think, 2005, something like that. There was a guy who worked for 6 years at Amazon. And after about 6 months at Google, he wrote a piece about why Google was so much better than Amazon as a business and doing everything right, except for three things. And he looked at 200 different aspects of the two companies and put them all down. And he actually put them all onto a matrix and wanted to make it public. But Google's legal team said, no, you can't do that. We don't want you to do that. But he said there was three things that Amazon wins at. And one of them was basically Jeff Bezos and his approach to micromanagement. Not that micromanagement is a good thing, but the way they go about making decisions as a company. And I've got friends that work there and friends that have worked there. And there's a 6-page kind of memo that if you want to make a change, you've got to put together a 6-page memo. And there's a very, very rigid system for how you go about communicating and chains of making things happen. And it's a throwback kind of piece. It's a little bit old fashioned style of writing, but it was really interesting to read.
No, I mean, that post, by the way, is written by a guy called Steve Hege. And I think that's one of the most, for me, it's one of the greatest posts of all time in terms of commentary on workplace culture. This thing is a mega, mega read. And it's coming from really his, an insider's view. It's not a consultant who's wandered in and read a report. He's an engineering lead in both of those companies. And he's encountered these things, positive and negative, in both of these mega businesses and just documented it. And this is proper first-person anthropological analysis. And he's broke it down, and it's just a brilliant read. And I agree with you. I think Bezos, obviously, he gets hammered. He's a popular individual to hammer because he is the richest man in the world, second richest, whatever it is. And, cool to hammer billionaires at this point. I totally get that. Global inequality is unacceptable at this stage. But at the same time, in terms of his ability to convert Amazon from a bookseller, when I first came across Amazon, that's all they were. Cool companies selling books. To a point where essentially they're doing things like dominating cloud. They're sending a rocket ship to Mars. They obviously own delivery, logistics, supply chain, all of that type of stuff. It's a remarkable journey of business. Bezos is stepping down, but it's obviously not over. He's thinking about other things, such as getting off the planet. So watch this space in terms of what he's going to be doing.
Yeah, when you say, I mean, you I know you know this, and you were shortcutting it, but when you said when you came across Amazon, it was a bookseller, and I mean, everybody knows that was only a bookseller to the public. It was never going to be a bookseller. It was going to be what it is today from the beginning. The original business plan is basically Amazon today.
Yeah, I mean, the dude just executed on it. I mean, and he is maybe in all of these stories about sort of these bosses being terrible. Steve Jobs has got this reputation for being also fundamentally unpleasant and stuff. And I get it. Elon Musk also. And we should not be deifying anybody in this day and age. But at the same time, I just wonder whether there's a pattern of behavior that may be a requirement to control a business of that type of size, where there are so many other personalities and so many other kind of competing forces. It may be you need to have some form of leadership of this type of manner.
This is not new. It's not new. It's like Roman emperors were exactly the same characteristics. Adolf Hitler had the same characteristics. If not the same, thought.
I would have hoped you'd have quoted a better option than that.
But he did. I mean, complete dictate, dictatorial. This is the way we're doing it, and you're doing it, and you're doing what I say. It's not new. It's just applied to business.
It is. And you know what? Probably it's the natural form of how a business is, because it starts off with a CEO, right? Like a person typically driving the car by themselves. And then you start including a few other people that you still dominate because you're the main person. And then even as that scales up, you may still maintain that imprint. So there has to be a movement away from it. But at the same time, leadership styles, that's probably something that's also another topic worth discussing. I think super interesting to figure that one out and, you know, what the impact that is in recruiting as well. So, you know, lots of interesting things to unpick. Okay, one more, Adam.
Oh, that's difficult because I've got eight written down and I've got another four ticked. Let's do, I actually commented on it on LinkedIn, so I'll do it. Andre Bradshaw's, caveat here, I haven't watched the video, yep. But I've read the analysis from Balazs, mm-hmm. about Andre Bradshaw's research around the rise of the talent source or job title and recruitment titles where they've got a significant sourcing element to how they describe their job on LinkedIn. Yep. And it's gone up to a certain level from around about 2008, 2009 to 2019. And then it started to go down again a little bit in terms of people who appear to be totally focused on this subject. And I think that's really natural because technology is automating a lot of that. And I've said this to you before, LinkedIn, I was at Sozu in 2017 and in front of 300 sourcers, I told them, you're going to need to become nurture marketers and data analysts. And I can see it happening. I can see these people doing it right now. The people I know who were pure sourcers back then, they're building pipelines and they're nurturing those pipelines and they're doing a lot of data analysis and they're doing talent intelligence because finding people is not as hard as it was. So it's really interesting.
Yeah. I've shared that link, by the way. That YouTube channel, that YouTube is definitely worth watching by Andre. It's only about 10, 20 minutes or so, but he's basically breaking down his research. So there's lots of things to learn if you're a technical source of any type anyway. You know, there's things in terms of his process and his method and so on. But the bottom line is what he's done is scrape LinkedIn, I think over maybe a 15-year period, looking for sourcing in their profile. And then look, I guess counting the textual analysis, counting the word count on it to say whether it's more prevalent or not. And I think it does describe sort of the emergence of sourcing as an independent function. And then it kind of now folding back in to the standard work of recruiting. So it is super interesting. There's no doubt. I'm of the view that it probably is the decline, I think, is permanent. It's going to keep slowing down in terms of the prevalence of the term. And I think that's predominantly because sourcing is one of those automatable activities, in my view. And ultimately, it's the problem set from recruiting has shifted from the discovery point to the point of, you know, the engagement, as you mentioned. So I think that is definitely the case. Okay.
It's also not, just really, really quickly to add to that, it's also not hugely different to the job of an executive search researcher.
Right.
And that's been a 1970s job when that was created. So the only big difference is, of course, that the internet, LinkedIn especially, democratized, you know, information. And so it became much easier to extend what an exec search researcher did into like more sort of higher volume areas of recruitment.
Yeah, it tracks social media, mate. I mean, ultimately, the yes. emergence of sourcing that we currently know it essentially came as a result of all us human beings putting out this digital footprint by being on Facebook and LinkedIn and Twitter and those types of places. And then recruiters who knew how to do it realized, hey, this person doesn't need to have to create a CV or a resume for me to understand that could be a potential candidate. If this person is just tweeting about Java all the time, presumably he may be a Java developer. So that is sourcing. And it tracks that emergence of that sort of activity. But like I say, you know, that's the big difference I would say between exec search and sourcing per se. But it is fundamentally the same activity. It's trying to find non-structured information that tells you that person's a candidate. So absolutely. Okay, cool. We're talking about another topic though today, which is people analytics, otherwise known as, well, people analytics is worth defining the term. It is the way to kind of understand your workforce via their activity. And these days, I think super interesting because we're doing a lot of personal analytics ourselves anyway. Do you wear a Fitbit, for instance? Are you tracking your steps? Are you looking at your screen time? Do you have things to help you with, you know, your consumption of media? All these types of things are part of your personal analytics suite. And I think we're definitely getting more sensitive to it. I'd actually be interested to know, like, who has a wearable? You know, please let me know in the comments. Are you? Yeah, exactly. Most people have them, right? At least, you know, a significant percentage does. And it's really interesting because the reasons why we have that wearable device is because we want to learn about our own behaviors, our biological responses to the things we do, and then maybe get better at it, right? You know, if we start recognizing our sleep patterns are all out of whack, maybe it makes sense to try and track how we sleep so that we understand, you know what, you know, this thing happens if I do this, maybe I should stop doing that, and then, you know, you get better sleep. Now, the big question for us now is, what happens when this type of information or similar types of information is shared with your company and your employer? So, for instance, a couple of things have occurred that were really interesting. There was a device, for instance, that was produced and marketed that helped track employees' mood. Right. So very similar to a wearable, but it would track your heart rate and stuff like this, your mood. And it was presented very much as a employee welfare device. In other words, this will all be plugged into a system. An administrator will look at that system and then they'll be able to understand, oh, you know, Adam's not feeling so good. It looks like his energy levels are down or whatever it is. You know, maybe you need to stage an intervention of some type, or you need to provide a different type of work to keep this person stimulated or whatever it might be. So it was marketed that way. But what do you think the reception of that product was, Adam?
Negative.
Overwhelmingly so. Overwhelmingly so. Now I want to basically understand, and I want to speak to the audience about this, like, why is that a negative? Like, for instance, we are tracking this information ourselves anyway, but why have we got a problem with our bosses knowing about this? Particularly when, you know, the boss presumably has our welfare in mind. I mean, would they not want us to be happy, productive, you know, emotionally in a good place? Would it not be a bad thing for a boss to be aware when we're not in those situations? So before I bring our guests on, I just want to ask you that question, Adam. What are your thoughts on this, and why do you think it's problematic if it is the case?
Well, I think the problem is that it could be considered intrusive. It could be considered micromanagement. It could be considered an invasion of privacy. It could be considered, you know, there's a lot of people that are very passionate about their privacy and about what people know about them. And they're not giving you their soul when they're signing an employment contract. They're giving you their time to perform particular tasks. So it feels like it's maybe crossing the line a little bit. Now, I personally don't have any problem with it, but then I've not worked for somebody else since 2009. We recently started using a system called Vue, V-Y-O-U, which is a startup from John Stanners, friend of the show.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all about tracking energy levels. So it's about tracking, you know, how energized people are feeling based on lots of different things. And there's about twice a day, you take 20 seconds, you answer 10 questions with a like 1 to 5 scale, and then you get a regular update on your own energy, and the company gets a, like, at a macro level, report on, not about individuals, but just a macro level report on. Now, I haven't asked I haven't actually asked the team if anybody's got any problem with this, but nobody brought up any.
So you just rolled it out.
We rolled it out and asked everybody to take part, which is, yeah, probably what we shouldn't have done. We should have asked them. But we've got a pretty vocal team, and I think if anybody had a problem, they would have brought it up.
Yeah, well, the thing is, I mean, once it's in there and becomes habituated, I think we would just roll with it. So I'm one of these people that are generally marginal, I would say, in my view, because I'm generally thinking that most of our fears are unjustified, even though they're understandable. Because the bottom line is, I don't see too many bad things happening as a result of this. There's going to be some episodes where productivity tech, I call it bossware, by the way, you know, where people take screen caps of what you're doing. There's technology that does that, you know, that randomizes screen capture. So you plug your, you know, some software in there, download something probably, and, you know, over the course of your working day, there'll be 10 screenshots of your screen sent to the boss. Now, I think that's pretty intrusive. But, you know, things like monitoring the health of the employee base, I would say that's not only something that's right for the boss to know, it's also an obligation, isn't it? Like, shouldn't the boss have that type of need or care for his or her crew? I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, maybe not. I mean, but it seems to me that there's an obligation as an employer to do the very best by your staff. But anyway, it's an interesting topic.
It really is, because where does that end? So if your sort of culture is that you're a sort of duty of care type of employer, then it's probably within your rights, or certainly could be expected, that you would want to know a bit about your people. If you don't know, there's not a lot you can do about it. And I know that sounds like like a bit of a cop out, but if you don't know, what can you do? It's difficult.
Yeah. And thank you, by the way, Annette, on that comment. I do get it. I use bossware as kind of deliberate, to be honest with you, to try and sort of illustrate the fact that loads of people seem to have a problem with it, but also to try and explore the edges of where this ethical boundary is. It would otherwise be called things like people analytics, for instance, or a subset of people analytics. If you think about the analytics world, by the way, organizational network analytics is something that everyone should kind of be aware of. That in itself is also something that may be perceived as intrusive. You know, stuff like monitoring, like the volume of email dispatch, or trying to map the true organizational structure of your business based on the internal communication that you can now track. So in other words, you might have a formal org structure that you've drawn up in a chart, but is that mapped to reality in terms of who does what and when? It could be a middle level person sends an email and suddenly loads of activity gets triggered every time this person sends a message. Probably means that individual is super significant, that isn't reflected in the org structure. And as a manager, even as a HR person, talent development person, you probably need to know that, because that's a high A+ person. You need to keep that person in the business. Whereas someone who's walking around with a big title, but you know what, everyone kind of doesn't listen to what he says, that may be visible using ONA. So, but again, ethical, yes, no, I don't know. So this is what we're going to explore during the course of this chat. Anyway, let's dive in. And by the way, if anybody wants to come on screen and help us with this conversation, please make yourself known to us, because this may be your chance to do that. But we're going to bring on two amazing guests for us to begin with, because they've got a lot of expertise for us to share. Let me see if I can do this properly. Let's bring on Lital. And we're going to try and bring on Andrew as well, if he is there. Let me see if that is the case. Yes, he is. Okay, we're going to give them a go. Oh, there she is. There's Lital. Lital, good afternoon to you. Lital, I want to give your name a go. Lital Shema Chaim. Is that right?
Wow, yes, Lital Shamar Chaim. Yes.
Okay, I didn't get it right, and I apologize to you, Lital, for mangling that. Lital, can you quickly introduce yourself, like who you are and what it is you do?
Sure. So basically, I'm a people analytics leader, which means that I lead training programs within organizations and help HR and executive to start the journey on people analytics. I'm a data scientist for 20 years now. My former role was to conduct data science projects within HR, but today we have regulation and the ethics questions. So I do the change. I bring the change from outside the organization and help HR leaders to evolve in that space.
Fantastic. I think it's super relevant for this discussion because I think it's emotionally charged. You can see the passion that people have in the commentary. I'm kind of stuck in the nest a little bit with my viewpoint. So it'll be interesting to see, from professionals what all of this means. Okay, we also have Andrew with us. Andrew, can you quickly introduce yourself, who you are, and what it is you do?
Yeah, I'm Andrew Marrett. I run a business called Organization View. We were probably one of the first two people analytics businesses in Europe. We founded in 2009. I'd spent the previous 10 years doing lots of analytics in very large organizations, actually mostly around recruitment. So working one foot in the marketing analytics team and one foot in HR and applying the sort of really clever machine learning stuff that they were doing in marketing and applying it into large scale, increasingly internet-based recruitment. So lots and lots of data there. Started Organization View to do that. We've sort of morphed into doing mainly, we're known for text and understanding vast amounts of text data. As well as that, I founded and run the HR analytics meetup group here in Switzerland, and I've chaired numerous conferences over the last 10 years on the subject.
Great. I think we can agree we've got some brains in the room, which is fantastic. Because me and Adam, even though I think we both think we know what we're talking about, fundamentally we don't. We're fumbling around sort of this issue, but we do care. And we do care about, on the one side, we can see the business benefit of getting, more data is good data is my default, right? So it helps us make better decisions. But now we're running into these ethical challenges where we think, okay, how much is too much? And as some of the commentators there, Tom, thank you for your comment there. Why does an employer need to know this type of information? And I'm struggling to know where the line is. So I wonder whether we could start with you, Lital. The provocative title, where does people analytics stop and bossware start? Or if we don't like the term bossware, let's call it worker surveillance software. What is the line there? Or is it just generally arbitrary, like we don't know? What's your view?
Well, I think I should add more questions and not give the answers because the answers are not so clear. This is why we should discuss it. I think that people analytics as a profession is changing. We are going to see less programming within organizations and more buying and procurement. And I think that people who choose the machines that we're going to incorporate within our work in HR and in leadership, we should choose wisely and ask ourselves exactly that question. I think that it's a matter of values and boundaries and culture and how do you reflect and consider your stakeholders in the organization. Employees are stakeholders. I have mostly questions. I think that I can tell you that I think 25% of my training programs are related to ethics because I think that most leaders don't ask such questions and they are not aware of the ethical issues that are related to the technological solution that they incorporate within the workplace.
Right. So what you're saying, Lital, is that basically, sorry to interrupt, but I just want to summarize quickly and then we're going to have you continue on this. What you're saying is people analytics might be changing because we're going to buy a lot of kit. Like we just, there's going to be like this procurement push, but we're doing so without too much ethical consideration. And then we're at risk of potentially implementing a bunch of things in our businesses that may then spit out these consequences that we didn't even consider that may be problematic.
I think that leaders in organizations, they don't understand good enough machine learning and AI in general. So although they can spot ethical issues within the work, which is not related to technology, it's not so clear where ethical issues start, because they don't understand what's inside in this machine, where bias occurs, and when the intrusion is too much of it. And I think that what we need to do is bring those kind of questions into the awareness of business leaders and HR in order to help them to choose the right tools to the right business questions without hurting no one, not the employees, not the, not the business. And I think that regarding the answers that the you both offered a few minutes ago, I think that employees should first worry that some of the data that is collected could be turned against them somehow when productivity is low or for other reasons. And I think that in the future, as the people analytics profession is growing and evolving, employees are going to choose employers not only based on employee experience, you know, rating the employee experience and the employer branding, but also regarding the hygiene or the data ethics. I think it's an interesting direction.
Yeah, that's a really interesting additional point. I would definitely revisit during the show, Lita, which is essentially new employees coming in may actually start examining what your policies are in terms of data protection from an employee point of view, because perhaps they don't want to get involved in a situation where, you know, their data is exposed in this way. And this is actually really relevant because COVID-19 is obviously, we're still in the middle of it. One of the things that people are starting to say is, look, we're going to start wanting like vaccination documents, or we're going to want your medical history before you're allowed to come in. You can totally see the reason for that. You know, you want to be safe environment. You want to make sure everyone, other employees are going to be safe. But then you can start seeing certain employees saying, I ain't going to give you that. And then, like, how do you wrestle with that issue? So it's almost like, what is the needs of the one versus the needs of the many in some respects here? Okay, let's move to you quickly on this topic, Andrew. A quick overview to the question itself. Where is the line? Or is there one? How would you kind of determine what is, like, good practice in terms of collecting information for people's benefit, for the business benefit? Where does it become surveillance?
Yeah, I think one of the advice I always give clients is you should be absolutely transparent with your employees about what you're doing. You should be getting consent. And you know, if you can't explain to them, if you can't explain to the Works Council, for example, if you're in Germanic State, why you're doing it, and they go, yeah, that's a great idea, you probably shouldn't be doing it, right? You need to be always thinking about use of data, just like the tracking device, right? So there was a big thing about 5 years ago, companies sponsoring for Fitbits. And you need to be able to explain what's in it for the employee to do this, and also what's in it for the organization. And obviously, there are measures that we both suggest, such as aggregating data, making sure that all personal identifiers was taken off when you're looking at that sort of level, that would be seen as good practices. I think one of the other issues that I see a lot is that people are measuring the wrong things, right? So it's a bit like you talk about the sort of spyware where the camera takes a photo of you. And I think the Daily Telegraph put devices under people's desks a few years ago to measure if there was, you know, how long they're actually sitting at their desk. And that's just measuring how long people are sitting at their desk. And, you know, they could be sitting on their phone, you know, on WhatsApp or whatever the whole day. It's not actually productivity. And I think we forget this. And productivity is really hard to measure. It's really hard to put a number onto productivity. So people then try and do things like how long you're sitting at your desk, but it's only a proxy. And as soon as you start putting measurement in place, it sets up a whole set of incentives that cause people to act and behave to get the numbers right instead of doing the things that are actually right. So, a lot of what we see in measurement is, I think, too simplistic. Our workplaces are really complex systems-based environments, and we like to, especially technologists, we can get data about X, therefore, what can we do with that data? Okay, let's pretend that that sitting at your desk is actually productivity.
Go ahead, Lisa.
Yeah, I want to just add, there are research evidence that people are less productive when you use surveillance solutions. They feel less trusted, so they reciprocate with lower productivity. Their intrinsic motivation is lower. So basically, if you want to improve productivity, I'm not sure that using surveillance is the right tool at all.
Okay.
So beyond transparency, you need to offer people the collaboration tools. You need to offer them some kind of autonomy over their work, and not just tracking on them. And if you do track them, you need to clarify what kind of business activities are relevant for such tracking, and what is the actual benefit both for the employees and the business from that tracking. So you won't have any conflict of interest between employees and the business.
Yeah, so I think a few things are emerging from this. So transparency, Andrew, you mentioned that, you got to explain, if you've implemented something that does this tracking, you've got to explain at the very least, this is what's happening, and be very, very transparent with that. The second point, which is a building on this, is that ideally the employees would actively contribute to that decision and be participants of the implementation of this. So in other words, it's not like not like Adam's sort of top-down sort of approach. We're rolling out this tool, but that's, I can totally understand why you would do that. Because you're in a business, you got to do quick. It's like, okay, we're using this, and you can't spend all the time, trying to acquire a consent. You can imagine how long that would be if you had a massive 100,000-person business. You would not be able to roll anything out if you did that. So there's again a management challenge there. But transparency, number one, collaboration, number two, and then particularly the point you mentioned about what are you measuring, and how does that affect create some perverse incentives potentially, and how does it actually map to what the person can do or not? Let's move it to a different point. Let's imagine. We have the boss or the business has achieved all of these things. They've just said, we're going to anonymize it, number one, right? So it's not performance tracking per se, but it's trying to do a temperature check across the business to see what is happening, this, that, the other. Maybe it's an opt-in, opt-out type of thing so that companies or employees can say, would you like the company to support you if we see, for some reason, we don't want to call it productivity, but perhaps we can alert the business to the sense that maybe you're not responding to the tasks you've been allocated. This would be an intervention a manager would do anyway. A good manager would always monitor the capacity, the morale of their staff. And if you see a staff member that's struggling, you would do something about that. You wouldn't just allow that to happen. How is that different from collecting information? You have collected information and you haven't collected it with consent. You've simply observed it with your eyeballs. But now in a distributed way, you may not be able to do that without using some sort of technology. So how do we wrestle with that issue? Management, goodwill, right? I accept there's bad managers out there with bad intent, but let's imagine a manager with good intent wants to look after their staff, wants to do right by them, but may need to have some of this technology in order to do it. Any thoughts on that? I'll open it out to everyone here, Adam, you included. Thoughts on this?
I'm going to skip a response to that because mine won't be as good as theirs.
Well, I'm going to ask you this exact question from a different angle. In the recruitment process, would you be willing to offer your DNA to the recruiter? Because, you know, the manager can see your height, your color, your eyes, your, you know. So what is the boundary? It's the same question. And by the way, you said give your data voluntarily. I don't think that if an employee volunteers to give his data, his fitness tracking data or any biometrical data in a time of crisis when everybody wants to keep their job, volunteering is not really a volunteering. There's an issue here too. So
yeah. So what you're saying there, it's almost the illusion of choice, right? So if I deploy this and say, hey, everyone's got a choice, but everyone's concerned about their job security, then in fact everyone's obviously going to consent, quote unquote. But it's really like, how do you call this? It's pressured consent or something of this type. You know, where there's just extenuating circumstances for people to do that. Okay, very interesting.
My question is, because and genuinely I don't know the answer to this, what is the difference between giving that employer, when you go join the job, giving them your DNA versus giving them your fingerprint or versus giving them your national insurance number or any other completely
identifier
piece of data? I don't see an awful lot of difference. Really, other than they can plant it somewhere in a crime scene, I'm not really sure what the difference would be.
That's a great question. I think the answer is related to what is really needed for the job and the pay. You know, the salary to be paid. Obviously, employer need a social security number in order to do the payment process. But I'm not sure they need your biometrical information in most occupations to run the business.
Okay, here's one case where it is needed or perceived to be needed, and that's identity. So in other words, we're now in a remote world. I've just hired Andrew, or I think I have, but he's decided, you know what, he's never going to come on camera because he's got some reason not to do that. I have to respect that. Fair enough. But who's typing into this? Who's doing the work? Oh, it's his 15-year-old kid that he's like seconded to do this job. And I'm thinking, I'm paying Andrew 150 grand or whatever. He's in Switzerland. I'm paying him like 2 million grand, whatever it is, to keep him in his basic standards of living. But basically, like, how do I verify this is the person? In fact, I think the BBC ran this, and there was a chap who got lambasted as a boss for employing what I would call his bossware. But he came from a culture where actually identity fraud was like a very regular occurrence. In other words, you offer a contract to somebody and it's the guy's cousin is doing the job. And you don't know, like, where is this where's it going? So he needed to actually, I think he's doing retina tracking or something to say, right, at least the person staring at this spreadsheet is this person and not somebody who had he's subcontracted. So in a remote world, this is actually a very pressing concern because you think about, okay, security clearance, stuff like that, or you're dealing with confidential information. How do you make sure that's entirely secure?
I think that's a really, really good point. And there's quite a lot around this new way to more virtual work. And certainly from the data we're looking at, we're not seeing any likelihood for most organizations going back to 100% in the office. You know, We spent a lot of last year looking at data from large organizations trying to grapple with this topic. But, you know, that sort of problem that you've just addressed is very similar to how schools have got to do when they're doing online exams, right? Is it is it me doing that exam, or is it, as you said, my 15-year-old son? Because for me, I'd rather my 50-year-old son did these things.
Do you have a 15-year-old son, by the way?
I have a 15-year-old son, yes.
That was a random guess.
It was. And if you knew him, it wouldn't be a random guess about me doing it. So there are a lot of these challenges. I think sometimes the technology solutions are too simplistic. When we're doing analysis, we're always dealing in probabilities, and we're always trying to stack the odds in our favor. And a lot of time, the recommendations get taken as fact, right? So, you know, let's say an attrition model. A good attrition model is about 82-85% accurate. Turns out that Russian roulette, you're safe 82.5% of the time. So, you know, it's about the same level of accuracy as Russian roulette. But you've got these when you give a recommendation to somebody, they may take it, that's definitely going to happen. And then the whole behavior gets skewed around this. And I think we have a big challenge. Because we're used to, as individuals, we're used to systems having rules, and they give a recommendation and it's yes or no. But now with the sort of technology that Lita was mentioning a few moments ago, which I think we're all going to see coming more and more, we're actually just giving recommendations based on what's the most likely thing and what's the probability of that. And, you know, we have to then interpret it in terms of the cost and the benefit of each action. And I just don't think that a lot of people have made that jump from a world where computer told us with absolute certainty what it believes is happening, and what is, you know, how do you interpret probabilities? And you know, Microsoft's got a whole big research group around interpretation of machine learning algorithms, and these are a lot of the sort of things that you talk about. The probabilities of them are usually quite small, right? So you're usually not very confident at all. But it doesn't sell to say, actually, we're only 65% confident. Sentiment analysis on text, which is my domain, is about 65% accurate, right? But that's just over a head. But no sentiment analysis tool will tell you that they're only 65% accurate, and, you know, just over half the time they'll get it wrong, because that doesn't do good marketing. So there's a whole range of different interpretation of these type of techniques and models, which I think is as dangerous as measuring them in the first place.
There's got to be a gradient, I think, because if you're working in a, you know, in Walmart or, I don't know, a hotel or something like that, then you probably don't need to give your DNA for that. But if you're working in MI6 or Mossad or something, then they're probably going to want to know that you are the same person each time, as Hung pointed out. A bit less maybe for, you know, swapping somebody as for being like cloned or something,
but I suspect the person going into MI6 understands the logic behind it, and yes. I think that's the key point. So if I, you know, went to work in a bookshop, I don't need to give that information, and if my new employer asked for it, I would just say, you know, what on earth has that got relevant to
what if that bookshop was due to become Amazon?
Well, the Amazon thing,
they might have to give a blood sample at the beginning.
Yeah, the Amazon thing's really important because Amazon, you know, as you can see from behind, I spend a lot of money on books. I have an addiction on it. And, you know, I've used Amazon a lot. They're not in Switzerland, but I have used Amazon a lot. And they send me emails recommending products. And I believe that's one of the best ways for them to sell products is do recommendations. Well, if they send me recommendations and they're not right because they're based on, I don't know, some book I bought for my nephew for his birthday and I wouldn't normally read it, then there's really not much cost to Amazon of getting it wrong. In an employee setting, the cost of getting it wrong can be enormous, right? If you get it wrong and it turns out to be a diversity case. I remember working in a case in one of the banks in the past where we had a diversity case of a senior executive, and it was $22 million the settlement on it, right? And that's not even accounting the publicity of getting it wrong. So for Amazon, the cost of getting it wrong is minor, so you may as well just send recommendations. For HR, it could well be enormous. And in most instances, when we look at it, the benefits of getting it right often are a lot smaller than the costs of getting it wrong.
That's the reason why you must educate executives about machine learning so they understand that there's always an error. It's the, no model is 100% accurate, and they stop listening to you as they receive the prediction. They don't hear you talking about the accuracy of the model. So very much, I think that practical machine learning should be taught at school.
I think the literacy, a lot of this is due to a lack of literacy, of which I would claim, you know, at front of the queue in terms of my lack of understanding of all of this. But it can generate a lot of the concern, because we always kind of have the either the best case or the worst case image to help us understand these topics. And actually, maybe Adam's point of it being some sort of a gradient generally is probably about right. And it isn't a case of just extreme cases. Let's appreciate the sort of time is moving on. So I want to just deal with one quick kind of thought experiment before we get to the questions. By the way, if anybody has any questions for our guests, please ask them and ask a question at the bottom of the screen there. We're going to get to them in a moment. Let's talk about ideal case. So let's say we could wave magic wands here and we could say, you know what, we want to strike a balance between being able to get the right information to a business in order to best support their workforce, especially in a distributed way. Let's not forget that this may be the new reality. Back in the day, there would be a manager that might eyeball the situation or pull someone to one side. Let's have a chat. Let's go for lunch, go for a walk. Can't do that anymore. Let's find a way. What does it look like for a company that wants to implement some software and technology that helps them make better decisions, whilst also allaying some of these concerns that have rightly been expressed? Thoughts on this? Littal, go with you on this first.
Well, I think that every consumer of HR tech and people analytics software should understand the industry, so they be able to choose from options, not just choosing what their colleagues next door just have. And I think that the responsibility for AI ethics, which now is on the vendors, like they should make sure that the data sets are not biased. And no, the responsibility is on everybody, the buyer too. And what I expect to see is more tools, more metrics for ethics and for right decisions. Like, consider you you just interview your candidates and your employees, you will have the ability to interview your AI and tech vendors. So that's if I have a magic wand, that's the magic I want to create.
Thank you, Littal. There's actually an interesting dimension you've mentioned there, because you talked about vendors having to take on some of the responsibility. It's just occurred to me that, of course, vendors can play in the international space, and then local cultural traditions and laws actually has a huge impact there. So you can imagine that there will not be a global supplier that's able to deal with every single jurisdiction in an ethically sound way that complies in every space. For instance, just using casual example, in France, for instance, I think it's illegal to record someone's ethnicity, for instance. Like, you cannot describe anybody, you can't even capture that information. Whereas other countries would say, hey, that's the attempt to be racially blind. You can't do that. We need to capture it in order to monitor the diversity of the workforce, etc. So,
but even if you don't capture that data, and you capture other data that relates to ethnicity or gender or even age, you know, prediction can reflect biases regarding minorities or groups. Like, consider the postal code of certain neighborhoods that certain races are living there. So if you put the address inside the model, so you know the ethnicity without even coding.
Yeah, you can presume it. And in fact, I believe that's what's happening generally in France also. So you can guess it basically because of sort of distribution in terms of where people live and education attainment and stuff, which is captured. Okay, quickly to you, Andrew, wave the magic wand, man. What do you expect? Like, ideal case, we're not talking about whether this is going to happen, but if we could create a situation where, yes, we're going to capture more information, going to help the business make better decisions, but do so in a way that preserves sort of employee rights and so on.
Yeah, I'm gonna actually start by taking off the last point on, because we did some really interesting work a few years ago on this, where we had a large industrial wanting us to see if there was a difference between how men and women were talking in performance reviews, right? So did the manager describe men differently? Did women describe? And the way we set up the question is, let's take the text. If we can identify the gender pretty accurately just by what was written about them, then we can tell what the difference. And we use interpretability techniques to identify what it is about that. We could predict the gender just from the self-assessment form by about 70% accuracy, right? So you don't need to, the simplistic view is, oh, don't give the gender in and the machine won't work it out. It will always work it out. It'll pick out these things. So taking this forward, my crystal ball, and this is something I've been seeing happening, I think the need's high in HR. Whether it'll happen because of budget reasons as quickly as it should do, I don't think. I think we're going to get auditors who check the bias or non-bias of AI solutions. And I think you're going to have to get that to get some form of accreditation there. It's a really difficult job, right? Because the sort of thing I've just described where there's no mention of gender, you know, the mention of HR system was a good predictor because it was mainly women using HR systems. And therefore, if you saw put some data in the HR system, that was a predictor of gender. That sort of thing we have to deal with as machine learning people all the time. And it's, you know, it's a lot, mostly indirect type of discrimination. And I think because of the, you know, somebody will get hit with a discrimination suit, a very large discrimination suit because of an AI solution. And I think at some stage we'll see auditors looking at that. HR is probably the place where that's most needed. Then it's not going to be a cheap activity.
You know what? And that actually aligns with recent ruling in the US with the SEC filings, where human capital data needs to be now published to, you know, when you file your company accounts, for instance. So you need to start talking about, you know, your demographics and stuff like this. Which obviously means you need to collect it. Absolutely, it becomes more of an accountancy type of activity. You can see the birth maybe of an industry coming up on this, which, by the way, folks, may be a recruitment option, a sort of a growth area. Why not? Okay, listen, we have to move on very quickly, folks. Go on, Adam.
It's interesting you mentioned that as an accountancy option, since KPMG's UK chair had to resign about an hour ago. Right.
Did he resign?
Unconscious bias is crap.
I need to dive a little bit deeper into what he said. It was seemed to be outrageous, but at the same time, I just wonder whether he might have reported out of context.
Well, we did analysis on Glassdoor results of 100,000 reviews on Glassdoor for the Big Four, and the sort of things they're coming out with KPMG we saw is much more likely to be in KPMG than the other three.
Are you serious?
You can take that sort of stuff from Glassdoor, right? You can analyze.
Okay, I need that data. That's really interesting commentary because they need to know about that if they don't. But we'll talk about that. We have to go to the questions, folks. Let's hit them. Colin McNichol, who's been commenting and asking a load of interesting questions. Let's fire this off. First one, would it be okay to monitor employee activity to check for the use of porn or extremist material during our work hours? So pretty explicit. You're breaking the law or you're breaking the company rules using company equipment, surfing Pornhub. You're going to get fired. Is that okay to monitor that? Let's go to you, Alital. Give me a short answer on this if you can.
Well, I think, first of all, regarding my other comment, I think before we talk about what is allowed to do, We must remember that the trust has two directions, trusting your employees and trusting your employers. Let's not forget that. Now, we have policies in organizations. We have certain roles which are more sensitive to data, all kinds of identity, as we mentioned before. I can't give...
Come on, Littal, you can give an answer to this.
And I'm not going to, because it relates to each and every role within each and every organization, which has different values, different culture, different policies, different regulation in different states. There's no one answer to it. That's why every executive must be able to discuss these kinds of questions, so each one can answer such a question regarding his or her organization.
You know what's happened here, though? I think that will be handled on the employee contract, won't it? Because basically, there'll be a contract to say you are not allowed to use these sites, or there'll be a restriction contract to say you can only use these sites. And then if you deviate from that, maybe you can hit them with it. Okay, Colin, you've asked a repeat question. I'm going to skip that one. And also the gambling, that's also similar. Okay, so Lee Candiotti has had this question. I think we know where Lee's going with this, but let's roll with that question. So where does the line get drawn? Are we headed towards a time where health insurance provider requires a copy of your own personal human genome before they give you sort of coverage? Let's go with you on this one, Andrew. So this is, I think, a very US-based scenario.
I mean, here in Switzerland, we have 100% health coverage right here. Insurance, the whole business of insurance is about pooling risk, right? So the insurer's trying to sort of segment it as much as possible to ascertain your individual risk levels. But for example, I believe in the EU there's a ruling they can't include gender on car insurance, although obviously young men are pretty appalling in terms of risk part, but those type of things get brought in there. I think there will be legislation into what will be happening, because the whole insurance breaks down if you have no pooling of risk, right? So it will get legislated, is my view, certainly on things like health, which, you know, here in Switzerland, yes, it's 100% private health coverage, but it's also reasonably regulated. I know some of the folks who are doing analytics at the insurers, and the area that they're seeing the most improvement is they get very itemized bills from the doctors saying, you know, he was in, I did this test, everything's itemized, everything's costing. And they're building models to work out what are the doctors doing that they shouldn't be doing, right? Because it just has no statistical significance to getting the person better. And I think that's a fascinating way of doing it. But the DNA, the insurers aren't, you know, it's incomplete at the moment. And insurance will break down if you can't sort of pool risk and, you know, share that risk basically across groups.
You know what? That's just really interesting. And that's another can of worms, actually, because if you just got me thinking about the nature of insurance itself, it is inherently intrusive and inherently discriminatory. You are literally saying, we're guessing that you, having not committed any kind of scenario, we're guessing in future you are more likely to do X, therefore you get a higher premium. That sounds like it's an outrage, but we accept it, right? So yeah,
They're doing some data. So you talked about trackers perform. I share my data with my health insurer, right? And if I do 10,000 steps a day, they give me some money off. And if I do 8,000 steps in a day, they give me a smaller amount of money off. I remember a few years ago, I swam the length of Windermere, right? So it's, 16, 17 kilometers long in the UK. And I got out, and the watch said, you haven't done your steps. Because I spent 10 hours in the water, right? So my insurer that day had me under 8,000 steps.
Yeah.
You know what? That's like, it's a crazy, I mean, what I can say from all of this, from learning from you and Littal, Littal's been bounced out. I don't know why that is. You can, let me see if I can get her back. But actually, we're coming to the end of the show. So let's leave it at that point. I think what we've discovered is that there are a few things that you can do. If you're an employer and you're thinking about, I need to keep an eye on my employees with sort of goodwill. Number one, transparency. What is the software? What are you doing? Make sure people know about that. Number two, it is also about making sure there's collaboration and consent. They're actively consenting in this activity. Like, make sure everyone is contributing to this decision to implement whatever it is. And if you get a lot of pushback, chances are you don't want to implement that because it's just going to create a toxicity into the environment. And thirdly, and I think this is a point that Litao was keen to make, essentially there's differentiation in terms of, you know, what kind of role, what kind of function you're performing in the business, and what kind of information is collected and is it mapped to the function and role that you perform. Like, there's no need to take huge amounts of information where it's not required. So there's got to be, if you like, a guardrails as to when that stops. And yes, fourthly, there is going to be a new industry, folks. A data ethicist, it's already in existing, isn't it, Andrew? I'm sure that will be a thing. But also people that do accountancy-style audit, forensic-type audits on your data hygiene, is going to be a growth sector. So maybe something for us recruiters to get stuck into. Okay, Andrew, that's about it. I'm going to let you go. Thank you so much for joining us on the show. You have a very good weekend, sir.
Thank you.
And Lital, thank you very much. Sorry that you got bounced off there. I don't know what happened. I think it was just an internet connection. But thank you so much for contributing also. And that's about it, folks. I hope you enjoyed the show. A little bit of a change of pace. I don't know about you, Adam, but I've realized I need to know more about this. And that's my big takeaway from it.
You don't hear me often bouncing a question, do you? I think that's the first time I've done it in a long time where I've said, no, don't worry, I won't answer this one. I'll leave it to the guests.
Yeah, you know what? But it's for us, we're just stumbling forward as best we can. I don't think anybody has a degree of expertise unless you're focusing and specializing in this space. Yeah. But it does make sense for companies to employ people to come in and give them that independent advice. So maybe there's a fifth thing that we need to think about. If you're implementing software, you probably need to cross-reference that with someone outside rather than just keep it like as a local conversation internally in the business and just to give you a sense check as to where that sits. Super relevant, by the way, for recruiting because obviously, you know, we need to collect a lot of data. We do that anyway. Arguably, a lot of recruitment information is intrusive. So, you know, there's another thing we need to talk about, the ethics of sourcing, right? We'll go back to that. Dude didn't consent to be scraped or didn't consent to have your, you know, personal, you know, non-work profile looked at. So, you know, there's all kinds of gray area, even about the core work that we do as recruiters that need to be maybe surfaced up. Okay, that's about it, everyone. Thank you for joining the show. We'll be back next week. We've got a super exciting show for you. It is going to be another one, actually, that's going to be amazingly controversial. It's about how do we get DE&I out of HR and into the business? Because guess what? You can't do transformatory policy with regards to diversity and inclusion if it just sticks in our little HR silo. It's got to be out there. How do you get the business to care? We've got a bunch of people, actually. The guests next week are going to be line managers that take ownership of DE&I in their businesses, not recruiters. So I want to learn from them. I want to figure out exactly how they've got to where they've got to and how exactly do non-specialists actually involve themselves in this. So make sure you sign up for that. If you enjoy the show, follow the channel on Crowdcast. We'll be back with you next week. That's about it. Adam, you got to bounce, right?
Yep. See you soon.
See you later, hombre. Okay, thanks for watching, everybody. End of the show. Have a good weekend.